Hi there, it's Amy Hall here, and I'm one of the magazine editors at New Internationalist. And before this episode starts, I wanted to tell you a bit about our new magazine on the arms trade, which is out now. With everything going on in the world at the moment, more and more people are holding governments and the arms industry to account for a trade that is essentially making profits from the devastation of war. From tracking the weapons flowing into Sudan to how to kick out your local arms factory, this edition explores the threat the arms trade poses to our planet, democracies, and safety, and what we can do about it. And there's so much to explore with this topic, which is why we're launching a new series across our website, magazine, and here on The World Unspun, which is going to be getting into how we can build international links and hold our governments and institutions to account for their complicity in this deadly industry. So stay tuned for more on that throughout the year. But now over to Maxine for the latest from The World Unspun.
The neoliberals keep telling us that there are resource allocation questions in the world. You can't spend on everything. It's a choice you have to make. It's a political choice. It's an economic choice, whatever. Well, let's talk choices. It's a pretty straightforward choice. You can increase your weapon systems or you can build infrastructure for civilian uses. You can't do both.
Today's guest on The World Unspun is Vijay Prashad. Vijay is an Indian historian, journalist, and political commentator. He's the author of 40 books, yes, 40, most recently a book called On Cuba, written with Noam Chomsky. Vijay is the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research, the chief correspondent for Globetrotter, and the chief editor of Left Word Books. Vijay has a wealth of knowledge on a lot of things, including the arms trade. My colleague Amy interviewed him for our latest issue. You can read that article via the link in our show notes. My conversation with Vijay serves as an extension of that interview and touches on things like the high levels of corruption in the arms industry, why some governments choose military spending over social spending, and how we can continue building global movements to dismantle this deadly trade. And, of course, with Trump just days away from taking office in the US, we had to touch on that a bit too. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, Vijay. Welcome to The World Unspun. It's great to speak to you.
Nice to speak to you, yeah.
So I think before we get into the conversation, I think it's really important to stress that this is a super dangerous topic to write about. There's a lot of money involved. Over 40% of the world's corruption is estimated to be through the arms industry, and journalists disappear trying to investigate these issues. You yourself have been warned off many times. I was wondering if you could maybe start by telling us a bit about the risks that you face in doing this work and why you continue to write about it.
I mean, firstly, you continue to write about it because it's appalling. I mean, you know, we are watching an unfolding genocide of a people, the Palestinians. You know, it's happening right in front of us. And this is entirely taking place as a consequence of the funneling of highly sophisticated weaponry to the Israeli military from the United States, from the United Kingdom, from Germany, and so on. I mean, if not for the large U.S. arms companies that produce the 2,000-pound bombs, if not for German arms companies that produce the sighting devices and so on, the Israelis just wouldn't be able to conduct this war. If you go to a weapons trade show, it is super sleazy. You know, I mean, there are semi-naked women. There are people, you know, men who are completely out of shape, pretending to be, you know, really macho with guns and so on. And they are dangerous people because the stakes are enormous. You know, we're talking, you know, billions of US dollars. So if you come in and you start investigating a story about an arms company, corruption, anything like that, there's too much at stake. You know, you are just a little fly. They want to swat you.
And I think the sheer scale of the arms trade and just the global reach of it can make it seem quite impenetrable. I mean, even, you know, watching the way it's represented in the movies and on TV, it's this very shady business, a lot of sort of murky things going on behind the scenes. But can you sort of lay out some of the most important facts that people need to know about the arms trade?
Well, you started off with the most important fact, which is that 40% of global corruption, as it's been calculated, is in the arms industry. You know, what happens generally is that big weapons manufacturers go to countries and they say, we can provide you with these weapon systems. Here's the price for the weapon system. The governments, because it's such an enormous bill, often inflate the bill, and part of the payout comes into the pockets of ruling parties to run elections, or comes into their pocket for private gain. And so there's just an enormous amount of corruption in the arms industry. Clare Short, former development secretary in Tony Blair's government, said, you know, the problem isn't, if the whole issue is bribes, why bother delivering the weapons? Just provide the bribes, you know. But in fact, it's not that easy. It's not just about the bribes. Then comes the next issue, which is that once you start funneling vast amounts of weapons into the arsenal of a state, its diplomatic attitude changes. You know, it no longer wants to conduct diplomacy with its neighbors or others. It tries to intimidate them because now you have all these weapon systems and so on. History has shown us if you overarm two countries, they in fact do go to war. It's not true that arms companies or globalization prevents warfare. It can accelerate warfare. In fact, the arms industry is the accelerant to warfare because you suddenly feel you are invincible. You have the bigger bomb. And the temptation to use the bigger bomb increases. I mean, I've met a lot of arms dealers, and I don't want to say this and be said, well, you're prejudiced against arms dealers. But arms dealers are people whose ethics have been fully compromised. And the gap between arms dealers and major politicians of countries that export arms is zero. You know, a country like the United Kingdom, Keir Starmer can talk as much as he wants about being a human rights lawyer. The fact is he's an arms dealer. He facilitates the deals made by BAE Systems to sell weapon systems to Israel. He facilitates Elbit Systems, which had you know, very much more manufacturing capacity in the UK. The British Prime Minister is effectively the head of an arms corporation rather than the head of a democracy. So all that pabulum about human rights and so on pales in comparison to the similarity between the elected heads of these governments and the heads of the arms corporations.
And in the interview that you did with my co-editor, Amy, for our magazine on the arms trade, you said that fear is what fuels war and negotiations and arms control are what stop war. But when you know, given what we're saying about these leaders effectively being arms dealers themselves, and when you look at the state of the world today, particularly in Gaza and Ukraine and Sudan, I mean, doesn't it feel like we're further away from negotiating peace than ever before?
Not necessarily. I don't take that view in general. I think that people in larger and larger numbers are coming to understand that all wars end in negotiation, and delaying the negotiation simply increases the suffering. Oscar Lafontaine, former leader of the Social Democratic Party, then one of the founders of Die Linke, has made this statement recently. He said that, you know, it's about time we close this conflict in Ukraine, and it's about time we reopen discussions with normalizing with Russia. I think there's a lot of voices of sanity saying that war, in fact, is bad for the overall development of the planet, not just for the people who have been pulverized and butchered. It's bad for everybody. You know, how is the genocide in Gaza good for anybody? It's definitely not good for the long-term security needs of Israel, because, in fact, this is turning more and more people against the Israeli population. Israel is more and more isolated. The very fact that its longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has now faced indictment from the International Criminal Court as a consequence of this tells you that there's no benefit to this. You know, you can wipe out Hamas, you can wipe out Hezbollah, but there's always tomorrow. There's always another generation. Now, part of the problem is that all of this sounds apparently terribly naive. I mean, for years, when I've talked like this, very intelligent people will say to me, this is naive. You don't understand how the world works. In fact, I do very well understand how the world works. I very well understand that the vast majority of people do not want to live by intimidation. Most people would prefer not to have a fence that divides them from their neighbor. Most people would prefer that they have their, a kind of collegial, friendly relationship with people who are around them, not a hostile, nasty relationship. So I do very well know how the world works. Naivetes or idealism can go in many ways. In fact, I believe it's idealistic to believe that you can bomb people into submission. That is one of the oldest idealisms. It's an idea that has persisted and has not succeeded. Because guess what? Wars beget wars beget wars. Why not try to collaborate with people? Far better slogan, collaboration, not confrontation. You know, you pick your side. Both of them are ideas. So to say one is more realistic and the other is idealistic, in my opinion, is a political choice. You know, it's a political and moral choice.
And one person who said that he can bring an end to the wars, at least in Ukraine and in Gaza, is Donald Trump, who is obviously re-entering the White House in a matter of days. But Trump has indicated that he wants NATO members to spend 5% of their GDP on defense. What do you think this will do, and how will this impact the global arms trade if Trump makes good on that promise?
I mean, partly, this is not about Trump. You know, let's be clear about it. Mark Rutte, the new Secretary General of NATO, has himself wanted to increase NATO member state spending to Cold War levels. Okay, I think this is, to some extent, not a Trump agenda alone. So it's very wrong. I think Europeans like saying, look, Trump is making us do this. We are actually social democratic. Trump is making us do this. I think Trump is providing European leaders with an alibi to do what they want to do, which is to raise their military spending. I really don't think this is an enforcement coming from Washington. The kinds of statements, the sincerity of people like Mark Rutte shouldn't be shouldn't be misconstrued. Like, I think he's pretty sincere. He's saying we're going to go up to Cold War level spending. So good luck with that. You know, good luck, Europe. Germany's infrastructure is collapsing. France's infrastructure is collapsing. In the United Kingdom, you can't even build a high-speed rail that connects the country north to south. It's miserable. You know, it's embarrassing to see the United Kingdom not able to build proper high-speed rail. The United States infrastructure is declining. The Biden administration directly says it. They've tried to increase spending for infrastructure. There's no money. Okay, you know, when I was young and used to pay attention in school, the economics teacher said, well, it's a simple matter of the choice between guns and butter. That was how they framed it. It's kind of a dumb choice because why butter and guns? But let's say social spending versus military spending. This is a choice. You know, the neoliberals keep telling us that there are resource allocation questions in the world. You can't spend on everything. They tell us this all the time. You can't, spend on ending childhood poverty because, you have to facilitate the needs of the bondholders. And, it's a choice you have to make. It's a political choice. It's an economic choice, whatever. Well, let's talk choices. It's a pretty straightforward choice. You can increase your weapon systems or you can build infrastructure for civilian uses. You can't do both. You just can't do both.
Hi there. My name is Beth, and I'm a co-editor here at New Internationalist. Thanks for tuning into this podcast series. We'd love to know what you think about it. Please send us a voice note with your questions and comments about the show to be featured in an upcoming episode. Keep it short, just under a minute, and email the file to submissions@newint.org with the subject line feedback. We can't wait to hear from you.
I was in Japan recently, and I went to the Peace Memorial in Hiroshima, which I don't know if you've been to, but is just like an incredibly powerful exhibition and memorial. And in the first part of the exhibition, you're taken through the sort of human impact of the world's first use of an atomic bomb and just this awful harrowing imagery and stories of what happened to people and the long-term health impacts and destruction of infrastructure and all of that. And then in the second part of the exhibition, you're sort of taken through the history and the context and what actually led to the development of the atomic bomb. And one of the things on display is this letter from Albert Einstein to the then US President Harry Truman, in which he says that the US will need to source these massive quantities of uranium to build the bomb, and they would source that from the Belgian Congo. And I remember just reading that and thinking like, oh, well, you know, that's convenient. They can just go to the Belgian Congo and get all the minerals that they need and build this massive deadly weapon. And, you know, in the magazine, we talk about a lot of different angles around the sustainability of the arms trade and the sort of greenwashing of the arms trade. But I was wondering if you could sort of talk about this aspect of the role of imperialism. And is it still a matter of the global north exploiting labor and resources from the global south to fuel this trade? Or is it a little bit more complex than that today?
Well, firstly, that letter you read from Einstein to Truman is about the Shinkolobwe mine, the uranium mine in the Congo. And it's important to say that 15 years after the United States dropped atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, using uranium from the Shinkolobwe mine in the what was then the Belgian Congo, the Congo gets its independence 15 years after that. And the leader of that independence movement was Patrice Lumumba, who was, you know, very, very articulate, intelligent political leader, understood exactly what was going on, the context of the Congo and so on. As Lumumba started taking charge of his new country, he put forward the idea that the Congo had to establish its sovereignty over its minerals and metals, including uranium, had to consolidate its own control. As a way to start diminishing the Congo's sovereignty from its newly found or won independence, the Europeans and the United States engineered secession movement in Katanga province, which is, you know, very important for a number of minerals and metals, including copper. And this so-called secessionist movement was engineered to weaken the hand of Lumumba, and then he was executed. He was assassinated. And the Congo went under a long period of effectively US-backed dictatorship led by Mobutu Sese Seko. Why am I telling you all this? Because it's really important to understand that as the Congo wins its political independence after decades of struggle against the Belgian rule, the United States, Britain, the Belgians, and others collude in a coup d'etat against Patrice Lumumba, democratically elected, because they were afraid that the Shinkolobwe mine might be, you know, under the control of the Soviets, or for which there was no indication, okay, or the Soviets might be able to have access to that uranium, because, of course, it's a Congolese mine, but the West must control who gets it. Control of resources must be with the West. That attitude, which led to the murder and the dissolving of his body in acid of Patrice Lumumba, where one or two teeth were saved and then taken to Belgium and kept in a box as a relic of what they had done to the Congo, that act of violence, savage violence, by the Europeans and the United States against the Congolese people, that act of violence, in fact, stays intact. That till today, Western countries believe that it's their right to control metals and minerals around the world. There are coups all the time against countries where they are trying to establish their sovereignty. In fact, very interesting, in the Sahel region in Africa, in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger being the most important for this, there have been a series of actually anti-imperialist coups led by various mid-level military officers. The most interesting is Niger, because in north-central Niger, in the town of Arlit, there is a very large uranium mine which produces yellowcake uranium. The French had basically controlled that mine until this military coup. And they used it as their property. You know, the uranium was just going to France for almost nothing. They were paying the Niger population almost nothing. Now there's been a coup, and the Niger government is trying to establish sovereignty over the mine. What do the Europeans do? They start amassing troops south of Niger's border, in Nigeria, trying to use Chad and so on. But popular sentiment around that belt of Africa is France, dégagez, you know, France, get out. It's an important kind of conflict that is taking place here. These countries are strange military coups, but dedicated to peace. They don't want a war. They don't want their minerals and metals stolen from their countries. The West, on the other hand, in the name of peace, wants to conduct wars and military coups so that they can maintain control over raw materials, metals, and so on. This actually is a straight line from the murder of Lumumba to the kind of shenanigans of Western countries today. It's a it's a straight line. There is, in fact, no real change of method and attitude.
You did a really interesting interview with Palestine Deep Dive, in which you said that confronting the U.S. war machine requires a geopolitical shift. I'm wondering if you can talk about how you see that geopolitical shift taking shape and what sort of the role of internationalism and how internationalist politics play into that.
I mean, it's already happened. You know, the center of gravity of the world economy has already shifted to Asia. It's already happened. Big things are happening in terms of economic growth, poverty alleviation, increases in life expectancy. All of this is happening in India, Indonesia, China, Vietnam, Bangladesh. That's where things are happening. You know, you're seeing declines manifest themselves in the data when it comes to the North Atlantic states and so on. You know, Javier Milei of Argentina can talk all he wants about Western civilization and Christianity and so on. When you go to Buenos Aires, it's an absolute disaster. Things don't work, you know. You land in Shanghai, 40% of cars in the city of Shanghai are electric cars. In Beijing, the government has a plan to basically shift non-essential, non-governmental institutions to a city they are building for 1 million people outside Beijing, which is going to be carbon neutral. They're doing incredible things, you know. There's no space in the Western media to cover any of this because, you know, after all, that would mean that you're pro-Chinese or, you know, you need to be against the Chinese. This is the attitude of the so-called left, even in the Western countries, is that they are more afraid of China than they're afraid of their own arms companies and so on that are obliterating the world. So if you can't open yourself to these new developments taking place in the world, the shifting of the center of gravity and so on, to kind of open yourself up to that, you don't understand that the world has already changed. And it's changed for the better.
So one of the things that Amy really lays out in her piece, or one of her pieces in this issue, is the success of different movements in actually blocking the arms trade. And you sort of laid this out earlier in the conversation in that, you know, things may look really bleak, but action is being taken and things are changing. What do you sort of think of the global movements so far and the action that's being taken? Is this something that, you know, we just need to keep doing more of it and, you know, eventually we'll see the change that we need to see? Or do you think that a change in tactic is needed to truly tackle this massive, deadly industry?
There are many ways to look at this. You know, one is, I think it's really important to continue to build popular movements in countries which are the main arms producing and arms exporting countries. I think that's important, you know, and I think that'll have its own dynamic and one doesn't have to call for it. It's already there. You know, there have been peace movements ever since there's been war. And, you know, ever since the US dropped the atom bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, pretty serious people have called for, you know, disarmament and so on. That's already there. It's happening. I wish it was bigger. I wish it was stronger, but it has its role. Then I think the other side of it, which I think has much more capacity to create a problem, is when you start seeing countries produce their own arms trade, their own arms industry. See, for a long time, Western arms countries have had a vast monopoly, you know. Everybody buys from Lockheed. Everybody buys from Boeing. Everybody buys from Northrop Grumman. Everybody buys from you know, BAE Systems and so on. So they sell to all sides of the war, you know. And then there's the secondary arms trade, which we haven't talked about, which is the kind of used weaponry, which is enormous. I mean, you go to, let's say, in Sudan, a lot of the fighting is with second used weapon systems, including tanks and so on. Anyway, the point is the West has basically dominated the arms trade for a very long time and sells to everybody, you know, all sides. But now things are different because countries are developing their own industrial capacity to produce weapons. They don't need to import weapons. And I wonder if the profit margins for companies like, you know, not Lockheed and Northrop and the big ones, but the next level company, Sikorsky, let's say, produces Black Hawk helicopters. If they're not getting the kind of US government subsidies, if they're not getting the vast markets of the Middle East and so on to generate profits, maybe it's not a profitable business just to sell to the US military or to sell to NATO countries. You know, if you're not going to get access to the Middle Eastern countries, you're not getting access to the East Asia, India, and so on, it's not a profitable business. So that's the second way in which, in fact, the internal contradictions of the rise of industry in other parts of the world might actually hamper the arms industry. It's not a short-term issue, but we're getting there. We're getting there where, you know, the U.S. government is just not going to be able to subsidize arms sales all over the world. You know, they just don't have the money for it. That's actually going to be, in a way, more efficient as an anti-war, you know, process than the protest movements. You know, that in fact, the internal contradictions of capitalism are going to work against these companies because they're simply not the boondoggle that they used to be. The third point about, you know, how the arms industry should be really seriously worrying about its situation is that as the weapons systems develop to be more and more deadly, then the question of the endless marketplace for your weapon systems decreases. So as you develop the big bomb, yeah, and you drop the big bombs, 2,000-pound bombs on Gaza, after a point, there's nothing else to bomb. So what are people going to buy? If I was sitting in the boardroom of an arms company, I would be worrying about these processes. Unfortunately, these are generally short-term thinkers. They are thinking about the next big sale tomorrow so that they can get their cut of the money and walk away, you know, and buy a house in the Bahamas or whatever. But in the long term, medium and long term, the arms industry is sitting on a branch that it's sawing and it's going to fall. And they're not even seeing that this is happening to them.
It must be very disorienting because, I mean, you said at the beginning, you know, people who work as arms dealers are just like so completely morally corrupt and compromised. I mean, it must be very disorienting to attend these arms trade fairs, interview these people who are just completely operating this like inhumane world. Do you find that when you go and attend these things, I don't know how much of it you do sort of covertly versus openly, but when you come back to actually write about these things, I mean, you must just really like lose faith in humanity doing this kind of work. I mean, it's obviously incredibly inspiring what you're doing, but at the same time, I just can't imagine interacting with these kinds of people on a daily basis like you do.
Yeah, but the thing, Maxine, is you do interact with them on a daily basis. I mean, you know, when you're in a city like, let's say, London, you're talking to them every day. You know, morally compromised people who defend, you know, the British government and its continuing supplies of weapons to Israel, or people who say that pro-Palestine demonstrators are just a little too aggressive, you know, and so on. I mean, we are surrounded by compromised humanity. Our task in the world is not to be arrogant and say, you know, we are not compromised and better than other people, but to try to move the conversation, society, in a direction that is a little more humane, you know, perhaps a lot more humane. I mean, you know, your magazine, The New Internationalist, comes from a tradition of trying to impose a little bit of humane thinking on the world. The reasons, you know, you found a magazine or work at a magazine like The New Internationalist is because you want to be part of a conversation to prevent, you know, absolute moral relativism and cynicism. Now, okay, you go to an arms show and it's pretty disgusting, you know, the kind of blatant machismo of the whole thing and the lack of respect for human life. And, you know, it's pretty blatant and disgusting. But let me tell you, I've been to media conferences where I felt even more ill. I feel ill when I sometimes hear even academics, you know, well-meaning people just talk as if the world exists, you know, as if what I see out of the window is the actual world. The issue isn't what's outside the window today. It's what are we capable of doing to the historical process? You know, without being completely idealistic and so on, there's a historical process. It's our job to identify the historical process as best as we can and to allow our people in our circles around us, the readers of the journal and so on, to feel like, okay, this is the process. How do I enter this process to move the good side of history against the bad? And frankly, I just think that the bad side of history exists. It's a reality, but so does the good side. There's a lot of decent, good people who are sincere and interested in making the world a better place. The issue is not that they don't care, it's that they don't know what to do. You know, what do you do once you find out these things? You know, this is not privileged information. It's pretty clear that what one has to do is get involved in struggles of different kinds, pay attention to what's happening in the world. That's what you have to do.
Thank you so much, Vijay, for making the time to speak to me and to be featured on The World Unspun. As we said at the top of the show, we'll be covering the arms trade in depth over the next year. So lots more coverage coming from us on our website and in our magazine and also on this podcast. So be sure to keep tuning in. But thank you so much to you, Vijay, for really kind of helping us kick this off.
Thanks. Take care of yourself. Actually, great timing. My headphones lost power just when we ended.
I know. I noticed that. So perfect. We'll just call it at that then. That was Vijay Prashad. Vijay is a historian and journalist and the executive director of the Tricontinental Institute for Social Research. Thanks for listening to this week's episode. We'd love to hear what you think of it. You can give us a rating in your podcast app, or you can email us directly with your comments and feedback to submissions@newint.org. And if you don't already, please consider becoming a subscriber by using the discount code TheWorldUnspun for 20% off your first year of a print or digital subscription to New Internationalist. This episode was hosted and produced by me, Maxine Butteridge-Mose. I'm the digital editor at New Internationalist. Co-editors of the magazine are Amy Hall, Bethany Riley, Conrad Landon, and Nick Dowson. Our editorial assistant is Paula Lacey. Our theme music has been produced by Samuel Raphael Williams, and our logo design is by Mari Fuz. Audio editing is by Nasik Hamza. Special thanks to the folks at Impress, the UK's independent media regulator, for helping us get this podcast off the ground. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time.